From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made yesterday morning outside a vacant house on Ames Street in Rochester. That's where Mayor Lovely Warren announced a plan to demolish all vacant homes in the city on the city's demolition list. At the moment, that's a list that includes 175 properties. And as our colleague Caitlin White reported for WXXI News yesterday, many of those properties have been vacant for years. The mayor says those vacant houses bring down a neighborhood in many ways: lowering morale, creating a place for crime, creating health hazards, lowering the values of surrounding homes. And so Mayor Warren plans to have every one of the 175 knocked down by the end of this fiscal year. For a long time, different organizations have weighed in on what to do with these kinds of properties. Some call them zombie properties. Others have different ideas for what we do with them. And this hour, we want to have a discussion about not only the city plan, but the broader issue involved here. I want to let you know that we invited someone from the city administration, either the mayor or someone from her staff, to join this discussion, but City Hall says no one is available. But we do have in studio Joe DiFiore. He's president of City Roots Community Land Trust and a board member for the Beechwood Neighborhood Coalition. Joe, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Julie Gelfand is a member of Take Back the Land. Julie, welcome. And why don't you remind our listeners what Take Back the Land is?
I will in a second. Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Oh, okay.
Don't you worry about us. We'll fix your headphones. You can just worry about the
microphone.
Okay,
because I'm not hearing anything in my earphones.
We'll make sure you can hear. Go ahead. Tell us what Take Back the Land is.
Take Back the Land is a... that's better.
We can hear you now.
Take Back the Land is a community organization that is concerned that everybody should have housing as a human right. And we are most operative within city limits, but not necessarily. We work with homeowners who are struggling to stay in homes, either through foreclosure or other things. We also have been taking on more renter rights, and you'll most likely be hearing more about that, too, because renters' rights and homeowners' rights really go hand in hand.
Okay. And Theo Finn is here, president of the Greater Rochester Housing Partnership, which is what, Theo?
The Greater Rochester Housing Partnership is a nonprofit organization located in the city of Rochester. We've been around since the 1990s, and we do numerous things, but with respect to vacant properties, we have a program that has been running since 2001 that we work very closely with the city and the Rochester Land Bank Corporation to implement, through which we renovate single-family homes in the city of Rochester for first-time homebuyers. We work with nonprofit construction managers and local general contractors to do that, and we've done over 700 homes in the city of Rochester since inception.
All right, so that's an idea of the different organizations represented in studio. I do want to listen to what the mayor herself did say yesterday, part of what she said, as reported by our Caitlin White. So this is Mayor Lovely Warren talking about why they want to take down those 175 properties that are on the city's demolition list. Let's listen.
The houses on our demolition list are beyond repair. They are unsafe and often contaminated with asbestos or lead. They can be a magnet for drug users and crime. These properties blemish the very streets we're trying to revive and make safer and more vibrant and more attractive to potential residents. They bring down home values, and more importantly, they bring down the morale of the neighborhood. We have dedicated funding to tear down every single house on the city's current demolition list. Every single one.
All right, that's Mayor Warren speaking yesterday. Julie, I'll start with you. How did you respond to her comments there on this kind of a plan?
I think that it's wonderful to know that these houses will be torn down. They are obviously homes that need to be torn down, that they're not going to be able to be fixed up, that there needs to be better uses of the properties they're on. However, I was also struck by the number. 175 houses is just maybe 10%, no less. There are at least 2,000 vacant houses in the city of Rochester. So when we're talking about 175, it's really just a drop in the bucket. And I think if we're going to be discussing the health of the city, we really need to be looking at all of those vacant houses and what that means.
Okay. Joe, what do you think?
Yeah, I would echo Julie's comments. And I think what we're looking to do with the Community Land Trust is look at some of these properties that are currently vacant, see how we can get them back in the home of first-time home buyers or low-income home buyers, secure them as permanently affordable housing options, and get them back on the tax rolls, get them back as something positive for our neighborhoods.
Okay, Thea?
I agree with respect to the 175. Those are properties that have been on the demo list and have been presumably evaluated as properties that can't be rehabbed. So that's probably the best disposition for those. And I do agree with Julie, there's a broader group of vacant properties that we need to be concerned about. I would say that the city probably doesn't have control over a lot of those. I think the majority of them are privately owned or in some foreclosure process, many of them. So there's an additional step that would need to be taken for the city to play a role, but there may be ways other partners can play a role.
And so if you look across a number of different media outlets, the headlines generally said, Julie, things like city, Rochester announces plans to knock down all vacant houses. And it's all vacant houses on the city's demo list,
right?
Which is much, much smaller than all vacant houses.
Not only much smaller, but it would have been crazy to try to knock down some of those vacant houses because so many of those are really in good shape.
So this is a list that nobody in this room is disagreeing that those 175, they've got to come down. Generally agreed upon? So those are the houses that, those have got to come down. And the mayor said they've got to come down. But when it comes to the 2,000 plus others that might not necessarily have to come down, there are questions that are, it's a little bit, is it more complicated to say, what do we do with those? Does that require a little bit more difficult discussion, Julie?
I think that the discussion goes beyond just those 2,000. Those 2,000 are symptoms. They're not necessarily the problem. The problem is considerably larger, and I think the discussion is considerably larger. It's like, okay, how did that happen? Mm-hmm. What do they represent? Each of those houses represents a different situation, and each of those situations is something that we should be discussing.
Okay. Joe, do you think we oversimplified a little yesterday then?
Well, yeah. I mean,
it's okay.
It's 2,000 vacant properties, so it's great that they're coming down, but we've still got a big problem on our hands, and we really need to address, as Julie pointed out, the systemic issue. Again, just putting a plug for community land trusts. Community land trusts have shown to have 10 times less likelihood of foreclosure for community land trust homes than homes that are in a traditional mortgage. So that's one way where we can start to address this systemic problem, where we're seeing a huge rate of foreclosures since 2008 and on, and it's still continuing today. And get these homes into community land trust, have them working step by step with a homeowner. When they kind of slip up, we have an organization there, a community there to back them up and get them back on track.
Okay, and Thea from the Greater Rochester Housing Partnership, if everyone agrees on the 175, then the next step on the broader issue is what? What would you like to see happen next?
I guess evaluate what those properties are, and I think there is an the city is tracking those, but to kind of hone in, probably at the neighborhood level, working, through neighborhood plans or with neighborhood groups to see what the best disposition is. And while our organization, does home ownership, and I do think that's really critical, there might be other dispositions. Demolition of some of those properties might make sense. Reusing them for, good investor-owned types of situations or affordable rental housing might make sense. Mixed-use buildings might be on that list. So I think it should be customized and should be tied to neighborhood desires and plans.
All right. Yeah. So listeners, if you want to weigh in, our guests are going to be discussing this hour how we get there, where they agree and maybe disagree, but the vision that our community can have for these properties, that sometimes it feels like an intractable problem, but they all come from organizations that have ideas for how we got here and what we can do going forward. If you want to join the conversation as we talk about vacant houses, properties, however you want to describe it, the issue going forward, 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994. Joe, can you help us as well understand the difference between a community land trust and a land bank?
Yes.
Not the same thing, right?
Not the same thing.
Okay, what's the difference?
The community land bank, I think, was what a lot of people are familiar with in Rochester. And I believe it was established in Rochester around 2014. And it's really an arm of the government that allows them to acquire property, in most cases vacant houses, and then rehab that property, get into the hands of an organization, and then turn it around, and it's usually sold to a first-time home buyer. And that's all great. We're glad to have the land bank. What the Community Land Trust does is an actual not-for-profit that's run by the community, And what it does is act as a steward for the land permanently in order to preserve the affordability of the house. So in other words, in the community land bank, the current situation, the house can be sold to a first-time home buyer at an affordable price. After the time period expires, 10 to 15 years, they can then turn around and sell it for whatever they want. So if they bought it for $70,000 and the value appreciates greatly, they could turn around and sell it at $100,000. Great for that person, not so great for the city at large and the taxpayer, because there goes that subsidy. Now we have to subsidize another affordable house. What the Community Land Trust does is say, hey, you bought this at affordable price, you got a great deal. When you sell it, you're going to get some appreciation, still walk away with your equity, but you're going to sell it at an affordable price for the next person. So you're paying it forward, you're getting a good deal, they're getting a good deal, on and on and on, forever and always.
Okay, so hold on. Before I grab our first phone call, I want to make sure I understand it. Mm-hmm. That person who paid $70,000 for that house,
yes.
If they paid $70,000, is it through a program that you're talking about that would prevent them from selling it at a big, big appreciation
yes.
in the future? They would be yes. capped at a certain level?
Correct.
And how is that cap determined?
Well, it can get a little complicated to explain, but at the crux of it, we would allow for a 25% appreciation cap. So that's the short of it.
25% appreciation from the initial purchase price.
Correct.
Does this prevent gentrification?
That's the idea, yep.
Okay.
Prevents gentrification, gentrification is a bit of a loaded term. It means a lot of things to a lot of different people.
Sure.
We prefer to, I guess, describe it as building up a community without displacement. So we want to make sure people get to stay in their homes. We want the communities to thrive, new businesses to come in. We want home values to appreciate. That's all great. But we also want to build in pockets of affordability. I mean, if you go in now and into some hot neighborhoods like the South Wedge or Neighborhood of the Arts or Park Avenue, I mean, good luck trying to get affordable housing in there now. It's not doable. It's too expensive. Right?
You bring up Neighborhood of the Arts. Mm-hmm. When we had a conversation this past spring about gentrification, John Greenbaum called the program.
Right.
John's been involved in a lot of local initiatives, organizations throughout the years, and talked about how he himself, having purchased a home in the Neighborhood of the Arts, now looks at it in the way that makes himself feel like, boy, did I contribute to an issue? And one of the things that John brought up was this idea, and John, if you're listening, or hey, somebody text John and say, I don't want to misquote him, but the idea I thought was very interesting. The idea to protect longtime residents was more about capping what they could pay in rising taxes.
Mm-hmm.
So they, so if you've been in a house mm-hmm. for X amount of years, you can only see appreciation of X in your taxes. That way you won't get priced out of your own neighborhood.
Right.
Because so it's a slightly different way of protecting people, mm-hmm. but I think it's the same kind of
well,
aim.
So I think what John specifically said was his biggest regret was not starting a community land trust in the Neighborhood of the Arts back in the 90s when he bought his home. And that's another one of the benefits of the Community Land Trust. If you're staying in your home and you want to age in place, as a lot of us do, you're not looking to capitalize on the sale of your home and walk away with thousands of dollars at the end. You want to hand it on to your children, or you want to stay in there until you pass away. This provides a mechanism for keeping it affordable if you're on a fixed income. If your house is capped at a sale of $60,000 and the houses around you are appreciating to $100,000, that property is going to be capped, and your tax rate is going to be lower than your neighbors, and thereby more affordable for you staying in your home.
All right, one more question for Joe, and then we're going to work through some other ideas, as well as your phone calls. But just to make sure I'm understanding here, so what you're describing, again, a land bank would be an arm of the government. The
mm-hmm.
land trust is an arm of the community.
Correct.
And what you're describing would protect these neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. What is happening in Rochester? Is there momentum and support for this or not?
Well, so one of the areas we're really focusing on is the Beechwood neighborhood, and that's an area of the city that's getting a lot of attention in general, whether it's through the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative, the Rochester Housing Authority, the Urban League, I mean, all these different organizations, private developers, private investors are all coming into Beechwood. They all want to get in on this area. It's getting a lot of attention, and to the east of the neighborhood, we have the Triangle in North Winton Village, very popular neighborhood. To the west, we have Markview Heights. We all know about the investment happening at the public market and all the new businesses going in there. We've got NOTA to the north, to the south. And that pressure is starting to come in on Beechwood, right? And we have to remember there's a lot of affordable housing in Rochester, but it's more and more concentrated in certain areas. And we may be an affordable city overall, but we have to look at it relative to the status of the people who live here. And people are paying a disproportionate amount of their income towards their rent or towards their housing costs, right? And if you're paying above 30%, you're paying too much. I mean,
now hold on. Now you're arguing for the program. I want to know if you're getting support to make this.
Oh yeah, yeah. Excuse me. Yeah. Well, my point being, we have a lot of support. Yeah. So the majority of for instance, the Beechwood Neighborhood Coalition, which I'm on the board of, several of the other board members are also board members for the Community Land Trust. We've got support from Northeast Area Development, NEED. We've got several of their members on our board. We've got support from House of Mercy, St. Joe's House of Hospitality, School 33 PTA. We've got renters,
what about the
homeowners.
City?
From the city, is taking the approach of kind of a show me the money approach, or the proof is in the pudding. So what they would like to see is a house that's acquired and rehabbed and put into place and shown as a working model. They want to see that specific to Rochester. So we have examples of, in Albany, there's a well-established community land trust. That's a nice local example. In Burlington, Vermont, there's a really well-established community land trust that's huge. They actually won an award from the United Nations recently. There's a nice one in Boston. So they're all around the country.
But not here yet.
Not here yet. But we're working on it, and we've got a lot of people and a lot of momentum. But particularly, we're focused on the Beechwood neighborhood, although we have support from all over the city at this point.
And who do you need to greenlight this from the city? Council, the mayor's office, the administration?
Well, there's a number of ways we could do it. For instance, we could partner with the land bank, and as the land bank acquires properties and they sell them to a homeowner, they could slip the land into the land trust, and then the land trust would carry on the affordability. That's what we do best. The land bank would handle the rehab. That's what they do best. It'd be a great partnership. There's a model for that other cities have taken on. That's the model that they've used in Burlington, Vermont, for instance. Some may know it as the home of Bernie Sanders, who got the community land trust there started. In Boston, they were less open to that approach, and it took a groundswell of community support for the neighborhood to do, or excuse me, for the government to do a 180. And they actually gave the land trust the power of eminent domain over their neighborhood. So now they have complete control of their neighborhood and the development that happens there.
Okay. So you're trying to convince the city to get on board. Fair to say?
Fair to say.
Okay. Let me grab our first phone call, and then we'll have Theo and Julie respond not only to what you're hearing there, but their own thoughts on what we can do next. But I know that Paige in Rochester has been waiting. Go ahead, Paige.
Hello. How are you?
Good.
Okay. I'm calling because I live in Dutchtown. And there are many empty properties here, but there are also a lot of absentee landlords mm-hmm. who buy these properties, never fix them up, never pay the taxes, and run them into the ground until they're boarded up, and then the city has to pay to demolish them. And when I bought my house 29 years ago, I paid $30,000 for it, and I put that much into it, and the city values it at $16,000 based on the surrounding area.
Okay. Wow. Julie?
Hi, Paige.
Hi.
So it's great. I'm glad you said this because it leads me to what I want to talk about, which is that there is an increasing number of investor-owned houses in the city. And that's the result of the bank foreclosures and also one of the results of investor-owned homes is an increase in the number of tax liens that the city is taking on, because the majority of the tax liens that the city has on their rolls actually are owned by investors. So what does an owner-occupy home bring to the city? A city can't really thrive if it only consists of investor-owned homes. But what's happening is that every time a home goes into foreclosure, it's very likely it's going to now be put into the hands of an investor. And I think I'm going to give some statistics about a particular bank. There's a bank called MidFirst Bank. It's only located in Oklahoma. The main office is in Oklahoma. There are three other states that house MidFirst, but none of them are in Rochester. MidFirst decided in the early 2002-2003 that there was a great way of making money, which is to buy up mortgages that were insured by FHA and the VA. And when they did so, they bought a lot of mortgages. They invested $7.2 billion in mortgages that were at risk. And not all of those were in Rochester, but a large number of them were in Rochester. What they did then was force these houses into foreclosure, and then with the intention of collecting the FHA insurance. When they do that, I'm going to give you some numbers here on what happened to those houses. There are 43 houses since 2012 that that MidFirst took over via foreclosure. Of those 43 houses, there are now 15 that are still in their name, and of those 15, 14 of them are vacant. Of the others, 25 were, let me find my numbers here, MidFirst. Of the original 43, all but three of those were owned by owner-occupants. Now, only all but three of those are owned by investors. That's destructive to our community. An owner-occupied house is a house that is going to be cared for. It's a it's an entry point to the middle class for the owner. It's good for the neighborhood. It increases civic participation by the people. And there's also a term, an economic term called spillover, when other people's expenses benefit the others in the community. So home ownership results in a spillover for the entire community. When we go to investments, which is what is happening, that doesn't happen.
So what can we do? What can we do about this, Julie?
We need to discourage homes becoming investment homes. We need to keep homeowners in their homes. And I think that's the biggest thing we can do. We have seen, because of bank tactics, we have seen so many people losing their homes.
But who's we? Government?
The city of Rochester. What can we do? The government, the banks, FHA. It's really a group effort. One of the things that's happening, and we do have a homeowner right now who was on the show last year, Liz McGriff. She's about to lose her home again. She's been fighting since 2014 to stay in that home, and manages to be such a brave and great struggler that she's been able to stay there. But MidFirst is the owner of that house, and they have gone back to court and have called for her eviction. The court has said, sure. And the sheriff is now sitting with this in his lap and does not want to evict her. He has been telling her he's going to have to do it, but somehow he just keeps on sitting on his feet and not entering. What can we do? We cannot do it. The sheriff doesn't have to evict her. The courts could
government
say...
Government can ignore, can essentially breach?
Yes. The government can say until MidFirst takes care of its own houses, until MidFirst stops causing vacancies. Most of their houses are vacant. If they're not vacant, they were sold to investors. A lot of those, nine of those houses they sold to investors now are vacant.
But MidFirst can say that's the free market.
MidFirst can say that, and we can say, but this is our market, not yours. And right. I think that this is about our community. It's not about, I don't want to go into discussions about capitalism, but it's not about making money. It's about supporting
community.
Well,
I think this is a little bit of a discussion about capitalism, isn't it?
A little. Yeah, I mean, definitely is.
Okay.
Definitely is.
I don't know why you're reticent to talk about it. Because there are going to be listeners who hear this and say, Julie, we don't remember the show with Liz. She seems like a nice woman, but it is not the job of the bank or the government to pay your mortgage, and if you can't, you can't.
Right.
And that is what capitalism is. And you say what?
Liz would be on the show right now if she could, but she's not because she has a full-time job working as a caseworker for Monroe County. When Liz is very capable of paying for her home. Right. Because of shenanigans by MidFirst, she was told that if she wanted to buy back her house from them, she could. They would sell it to her. She bought the house for $56,000. It's assessed at $73,000. MidFirst says it will sell it back to her for $130,000.
Yeah, that seems confiscatory, unless I'm missing something.
Yeah. And so there are ways that they can legally insist on that. We need to investigate those things.
But help me then see, because we're sitting here because yesterday the mayor of Rochester called a news conference to say the city is stepping up and it is addressing this problem. They're going to knock down all 175 homes on the vacant property or on the demolition list. As our guests have been saying, that's less than 10% of the actual vacant properties, and not right. all of them should be demolished. In fact, many of them shouldn't, but we have to figure out what to do about them. What would you say if the mayor called you in and said, look, you heard our announcement yesterday, we're doing our part. What do you want the city to do about this when it comes to the banks?
We need, and I know that in Adam Bellow's task force on vacant and abandoned houses, they made various suggestions as to how to keep homes in owner-occupied hands. We need to abide by those. We need to look into ways to avoid that happening. We also need to look into tax foreclosures, which also have caused people to lose their homes. We need to find ways to help those people who are trying to fix up their homes, but they don't have the money. They get those homes are often fined. And rather than helping them fix their homes, we continue to find them and grow them, and eventually the homes are sold in foreclosure sales. We need to find ways, and we need to investigate ways to keep homeowners in their homes and keep the investors out of them. Anytime an investor home is established, it's very unlikely that it will ever become an owner-occupied home. Owner-occupied home again. And the city is going to go under if we don't keep our owner-occupied people homes filled.
All right, Joe wants to jump in. Go ahead, Joe.
The Monroe County Vacant Property Task Force document that Julie just mentioned actually calls for the return of these properties, zombie properties, to entities such as Community Land Trust, as it specifically names them. And we've been advocating with MidFirst via St. Joe's House of Hospitality to try to get them to transfer or sell the Liz's home to the Community Land Trust. We were told one of the issues running with these big institutions, and we're running into this all over Rochester when it comes to the foreclosure process and bank-owned homes and investor-owned homes as well, but particularly the banks, is you have these large financial institutions where you call one person, you're talking to them one day, and you start making progress with them. The next day, you're talking to someone completely different. But we were negotiating with MidFirst. They said, make an offer. Well, we made an offer. They came back with a counter offer. We came back with another offer. While we're negotiating with one branch of MidFirst, another branch of MidFirst was moving forward with the court and the eviction process. So while we think we're negotiating, they're saying, yeah, we're willing to sell it to you, make an offer. Meanwhile, Liz gets a notice saying, hey, you're being taken to court for eviction by MidFirst. So one of the things that we can do as a community is put pressure. I mean, it's nice to have a document that says, hey, we want to get these properties. It's nice to say into Community Land Trust. It's nice to say we're going to demolish houses when they get to a point where they can't be rehabbed. But when we have an opportunity to actually do something about a house that is a vacant property in the making, where are our elected officials that come out?
But let me just ask you one more question. Mm-hmm. And I do want to get to our calls, Mark and Brad. I know I want to get Theo's thoughts from a Greater Rochester Housing Partnership on this. Mark and Brad, if you're there, hang in there. But listen, we know help on the federal level right now isn't coming. Right. Anybody who knows Steve Mnuchin's history understands that you're not going to see a change in disposition from the federal government. If anything, it's going to be more aggressive. And that is, there are remarkable stories. Read David Dayen's book, Dayen, if you want to understand the foreclosure crisis a little bit more. But on the local level, I want to understand is, are you saying that what you think the banks are doing is immoral or illegal?
It's absolutely immoral.
But is there a government mechanism to say you cannot do that? That's illegal.
Well, sometimes.
Okay.
I'm not sure about the government mechanism, but I can say the Office of Attorney General, New York State, has prosecuted, and there have been funds that have come into our community. I think the mayor may have mentioned some of those in the most recent press conference. So that's one way where the bank's practices during the foreclosure crisis have resulted in at least some resources to deal with the impact of that. I would just want to say something with respect to the comments about the landlord-owned properties. And again, You know, homeownership is ideal and we want to see more of that, but it's not practical that all of the houses are going to be owner-occupied, and we are going to have a number of investor-owned properties, and I think there are some things that could be done to try to make landlords more accountable, including local property management as one thing, being part of a landlord registry where you can be tracked and can be held accountable for your practices. So to the extent that we're going to have investor-owned properties, there are some things that can be put in place to make it a better situation for those renters and for the community.
And I do have a caller who wants to, in his words, debunk the perception of landlords. So let me grab that and we'll continue on that thread. This is Brad in Rochester. Go ahead, Brad.
Thank you, Evan. And first, let me say that I used to work for the Neighborhood Association Group 14621, so I'm very familiar with bad landlords and the problematic landlords. But at the same time, if you have a successful or a functioning real estate market, it changes the whole dynamic of how the homeowner and the landlord functions. And people are familiar with the Neighborhood of the Arts. It was a pretty depressed, valued real estate market. It wasn't homeowners that turned around that neighborhood. It was landlords. It was investors. In the South Plymouth neighborhood, you're seeing a resurgence of houses being fixed up. That is investors doing it because they think they can make money there. So if you have an area, a neighborhood that is turning around, investors very much can be part of the solution. And I know many, many homeowners that they can't afford their house. They don't know how to afford their house. And so home ownership is not necessarily the solution. I understand the bad negativity towards the landlords. There's a lot of them, and they're horrible, some of the things they do. But overall, if you have a healthy, functioning real estate market, that changes the whole dynamic. That's all I wanted to share.
Brad, can you stay there? Are you still there, Brad?
Yeah.
Stay there, and let's go around the table. I'll start with Thea. What do you think, Thea?
I think that makes a lot of sense, and as Brad's talking, I think about the South Wedge. I mean, I do think that a lot of the properties in the South Wedge were invested in by investors when that neighborhood was coming up, so there's truth to that, and everyone is not meant to be a homeowner. We need good, solid rental options for folks as well.
Okay. Joe?
Yeah, and I agree. I mean, I'm a landlord myself, so I hope I'm not one of the bad ones. I mean, I think we have to be careful when we talk about what a healthy real estate market is, because it means a lot of different things to a lot of different investors. I know a lot of investors in the Beechwood neighborhood who are great, and they're all about fixing up their homes, and their model is to get a home to a certain value or a certain state where they can get a certain return of investment. And I know others that are just about putting in the absolute minimum and really sucking the equity out of our neighborhood. And for them, that's a great model, and the market's functioning perfectly for them in both cases. So I'm not sure that I would 100% agree that it's investors that turn a neighborhood around. I think that homeowners play a huge and very large role. I know the Beechwood Neighborhood Coalition is very strong and has been a very strong advocate for our neighborhood. And I would like to think that we played a pretty strong role in the progress we've made so far, not discounting the role that investors have played, but it's certainly not there's a team to it, a team
element. And Julie, are we speaking too broadly about investors/landlords here? Does Brad have a point?
I think that no, I don't think we're speaking too broadly at all, and. I also appreciate what you're saying because, one of the jobs of Take Back the Land now is we do want to address renters and renters' rights, and therefore one of the things we're concerned about is that there are two types of investors that can harm neighborhoods. One, the ones who let homes go, they walk away from them. Those tend to be in the communities of color. They tend to be in the communities that are struggling with poverty. Then there's the communities where investors are buying houses in order to increase the rents and change the demographics of a community, and we need to be careful of that too. So,
how often do you think that happens?
It's happening. It's happening, Beechwood is fighting that from happening. It's happening in the Wedge. It's happening in, we're seeing that happening in the city. We're seeing all these glorious places going downtown, and ones that I probably couldn't afford to live in. And I look at them and I think, this is so wonderful, but who can live here? And therefore, when we're talking about Parcel 5, there's so much of a discussion within our community that we had to figure out ways to make sure that we are an inclusive community and not, and when we're talking about good investments and what's good for a community, we have to remember that our community is larger than a bunch of white people. And so one of the other stats would be that homeowners versus renters in this city, occupied homes in the city of Rochester is 41% lower than the national average. The number of renters in Rochester is 73% higher than the national average. We already have plenty of renters. We need to look at now what is benefit to our community and what is benefit to the economy of our community, and that's to increase the number of owner-occupied homes, while also not moving towards gentrification or vacancies because investors are not taking care of the rentals.
Okay. Brad, you want to respond to some of what you heard? Go ahead.
Sure. Well, just one correction. The neighborhood of the arts, the NOTA neighborhood, is between Atlantic and Peddler's Village. And it primarily, I agree with the one gentleman. You need both parties involved in turning around the neighborhood, but good landlords, good investors absolutely can be a part of it. And the comment about the gentrification of a neighborhood, to a certain extent, that's our goal, mm-hmm. but training I went to made a lot of sense. This was a training put on by the NeighborWorks of America. And what they had was a neighborhood that was gentrifying. But what they focused on as a nonprofit was making sure there was affordable housing occurring in that neighborhood so that you did maintain a healthy mix of people. And it's I don't know of another solution where if you're trying to achieve a healthy real estate market, and still maintain some sort of a mix of income and race and some of those other things that you're trying to achieve.
Brad, can I ask you one more quick thing, and then I got to get our only break of the hour in here. Yeah. Here's an email from a listener named CJ who just said, Evan, we were looking for a long time in Rochester, but investors snapped up homes before we could even see them. I am not sure how they even found out about them, but we found it really difficult to get a home. And in our neighborhood now, several sales go directly to landlords. How do we address that? Friends want to buy and move in, but houses just go to investors out of state. CJ's email, what stood out to me was the out of state part. There seems to be a difference between what you are talking about, your involvement in neighborhood, whether it's NOTA or anything else in the city, versus out of state investors with no connections and people don't even have any clue, you know, how these things are moving around the way they're. Is there a difference there, Brad?
I think there's a difference between someone purchasing out of state and then what you got is a property manager in the area that's managing the property and they are squeezing the property so everyone can make money. And they're not interested in
Listen, Brad, you gave us a lot to work with, and I really appreciate the fact that you called real quick because I got to get a break. Julie, CJ's email, he's concerned about out-of-state investors, and all of a sudden his neighborhood, he can't even get people who want to be there to be there. All the properties go to out-of-state investors.
That's happening more and more. And I don't think Rochester yet has been subject to what's happening in larger cities like Boston, where my kids live, where they're not just out of state, but they're out of country. And I have a friend in who has whose family owned a home in Long Island City where a Chinese bank is now trying to buy up properties on the entire block so they can tear them all down.
But again, if that's a problem that we agree on, tell me what one thing we can do to change that.
One thing we can do to change that is, again, we need to make sure that owner occupancy is a priority.
On the government level.
On our local level, on our community level, we need
on the grassroots
this
level.
Is yeah. So as much as we can be talking about tearing down 175 houses that are in horrible shape, we should be keep talking about how to, can we keep the people who are already living in homes here in their homes.
All right, Joe and Theo can jump in our phone calls as well. Let's get our only break of the hour, and we come right back as we discuss not only the city's plan that the mayor rolled out yesterday to demolish the 175 properties on the city's demolition list before the end of this fiscal year, but also the question, and well, what do you do with more than 2,000 other vacant homes that were not addressed yesterday? And our guests are talking about that. Julie Gelfand, a member of Take Back the Land. That's an organization in Rochester that believes housing is a human right. Theo Finn, president of the Greater Rochester Housing Partnership, which is a not-for-profit lender dedicated to the creation and preservation of affordable housing in the Rochester region, and Joe DiFiore, who's president of City Roots Community Land Trust and a board member for the Beechwood Neighborhood Coalition. We are right back on Connections. And let me tell you what's coming up Thursday on the next Connections. The murder of a Brockport woman has raised questions and some misconceptions about mental illness and violence. Investigators say the woman accused of the crime struggles with mental illness, but local mental health organizations say it's important to find a balance between having conversations about when to intervene when someone is facing a mental health crisis and when to understand when they might be actually in danger of hurting themselves or others. We're going to talk about that. Then in our second hour, we talk about a property that could have been demolished. A historic property in Leroy is now the home of 400 seats of three different parts of a new business called One Main Leroy and the Farmers Creekside Tavern, a remarkable reinvention story. That's our second hour tomorrow. All right, in a moment, we go back to the phones to Mark in Rochester, Elizabeth in Ogden. But Joe DiFiore, you want to follow up to what you just heard at the tail end of Brad's phone call. Go ahead.
Yeah, when we're talking about out-of-town investors, I mean, we already do see investors coming from Australia, from Israel, from France, from you name it. They're coming from all over the place and buying houses, often sight unseen. I mean, there's a trick that's used. You take a picture of a house in the wintertime when it's covered in snow. All houses look great. But they've never actually visited the house. They have no idea if it's got a new roof or if it's getting a new roof when people say it is. One of the things that we can do to curb this, and one of the things I hear from property management companies is that if a property management tries to tell an investor, hey, you've got to invest more money to keep this up, well, the investor's not going to like that too much. So they're going to look for somebody else to manage their property. So one of the things we need to do as a city, or the city needs to do, is really step up enforcement and oversight of these property management companies. And if the investors start to see that, A, when they go to a property management company and they say, hey, you've got to invest more, they skip to the next one and they say the same thing, they've got to make a decision. Is it still going to be profitable for me to maintain a house and get the rents that I get after the fact of investing, or should I invest in something else? And that's really the only way that we're going to see a change, because right now the property management companies just don't have an incentive to make any changes. They're getting 10% to collect the rent each month, and they don't want to be there any longer than it takes to exchange money from hand to hand. So until we can get beyond that, we're going to see, because that we've approached the mayor's been approached, City Hall's been approached through different administrations about this problem, and it's really always comes back to, well, it's the free market, there's nothing we can do legally to stop these out-of-town investors. That may or may not be true. There may be legal mechanisms that we can get, but one way we can address it is by really holding property management companies accountable and making clear to them that they have to have their investors invest properly and maintain their houses properly.
Okay, Theo, anything you want to add there?
No, I think that makes sense.
Okay, let's get back to your phone calls. And Mark in Rochester next up. Go ahead, Mark.
Yes, thank you. I'm calling because I have a certain perspective. I also worked in the neighborhood, Northeast Area Development. I owned a house, rented out the house. I eventually was forced out of the city for various reasons. One, seeking a better opportunity somewhere else. But when I ultimately lost my house or let it go, I see the primary problem as it's the city itself. It's the government. They, once they get their claws into you with their code enforcement, and they play all these games, they never let go. And there could be a house falling apart next door that never gets sighted, but once they get their claws into you, they just keep coming back. I've sat in front of lovely Warren when she was on the appeal board, and she wanted to hear nothing about what was going on in regard to the way that code enforcement was conducting themselves. My issues had already been fixed. They never even had an inspector go inside the house to be able to verify it. The lead abatement rules, they were citing federal code that talk about we have fixing stuff to federal code, but yet they couldn't tell me where in the 500-page federal code it even was. Then when you let the houses go to tax foreclosure, they let the big corporations come in and sell them off to whoever in different names, and for some reason they don't have to abide by the code enforcement violations in order to get their CFO. I'm sure in some cases they do. So they're just kind of overlooking a lot of that. But I wouldn't blame the problem on the corporations. That's an effect that's come many years after the city has gotten in the way. And also, nobody's talking about personal responsibility from the tenants themselves. It's an ongoing problem. Tenants have the right or the ability to fix the problems themselves and withhold rent. Very, very few times are they taking this opportunity.
All right, Mark, I just got to jump in only because we've got to squeeze in some more here, and I know our guests want to respond. I'll start with Julie Gelfand. Go ahead, Julie.
Mark, I think those were great points, and I do agree that there are some clear issues with enforcement of code and city tax liens that have not been to the advantage of our city, and I would love to hear more responses from the city on that. We did fight for a house in 2012 that we eventually got back for the owners. That it was crazy the things they fought with on the city on tax codes. Anyway, I would like to put out a challenge. Evan said I'm being awfully nice to the city.
I don't think I said that.
You kind of said it. I would like to put out tomorrow. Tomorrow is a. Is another debate, or is a debate, the big debate between the three mayoral candidates.
On the Democratic primary, yes.
We have been struggling, actually, to hear from Mayor Warren and get feedback and also get support. I would like to hear from all three candidates, when questions are asked, what will you do to go beyond the 175 vacant and what will you do to keep the houses that are in good shape here? What will you do for the owner occupants who are losing their homes to investors? What will you do to advance home ownership in our city? That's my question.
I will tell you that if you miss the debate tomorrow, the debate 5:30 to 6:30, and we're going to simulcast it on WXXI Radio. It's going to be hosted by WROC-TV and our colleague Adam Chodak and the League of Women Voters asking the questions. We reached out after the mayor's recent illness that forced the cancellation of the two debates, including our own Voice of the Voter debate that we were going to be part of. We reached out to all three Democratic candidates and asked if they would come back on this program one more time before the primary, even if individually, for an hour each to do that. So we got yeses from two of the three. So on Friday, we're going to have Jim Shepard in the first hour and Rachel Barnhart in the second hour. And City Hall has told us that the mayor just doesn't have time before the primary to come back on this program.
But we'll
see if that question gets asked tomorrow.
Yes, and so. Can I add one thing?
Sure.
Of the three candidates, we have had a response and we have had support from one of the candidates, and that's Rachel Barnhart. She did come to Elizabeth McGriff's home. She spoke in front of her home to the community. She is clearly willing to lend her words of support. I want to see that our local government is doing what they can to help people like Liz. I'm not seeing that.
Okay. And I will say, you really can't avoid politics 5 days before a primary or 6 days before a primary. I take that point. I don't know what Jim Shepard and Mayor Warren would say specifically to that question.
I'm hoping we'll hear that.
We'll try to get answers from that. I mean, certainly, I certainly don't know the answer. And I also, by the way, Mayor Warren's got She's got a very busy schedule. I don't take any offense to the fact that City Hall could not find time between now and the primary. It's just sometimes that happens, and the mayor has a very busy calendar. We understand that. Elizabeth and Ogden, I want to squeeze in one more phone call. Got to keep it tight. Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Elizabeth, and thank you. I had a couple of things. I know everybody's full of ideas and stuff, but I was thinking about those little houses that people all over the country are
tiny houses.
The mini houses, yeah, 900 square feet, 600 square feet,
400 square feet. Yep.
You know, because you can't plant gardens in all those spaces on account of the lead, possible lead in the soils. So, you know, maybe I don't know how anybody would go about doing that or attracting the people there, but I just know it seems like the mini houses are kind of cool and that might bring people in.
Elizabeth, thanks for the phone call. Tiny houses, is that an option? Joe?
Actually, there was a proposal few years ago, maybe, that was brought to City Hall in order to build some tiny houses, primarily for the homeless community as a way to get them off the streets and into homes and try to transition them towards homeownership. And unfortunately, City Hall couldn't make that happen for whatever reason, but I think there's still some interest in seeing that happen. As far as the current zoning code, it doesn't allow for tiny homes, as far as I know, unfortunately. But it would be interesting to see. You could put them on some of these vacant lots, perhaps the ones that are being created through these demolitions. As far as the idea of growing on these lots, I think you can do that. People use raised beds to do so, and it'd be great to start being creative with some of these vacant lots, doing some urban agriculture. There's some groups working on that, and it's great to look around at other cities around the country and see what they're doing and how they're getting creative with the vacant lots. And I think we can do a lot more than we are.
I want our guests to tell you where you can learn more about their organizations online if they want to do that. Joe, where would you send people?
You can go to cityrootsclt.org.
cityrootsclt.org. Julie Gelfand, Take Back the Land.
Probably currently on Facebook, Take Back the Land Rochester, a Facebook page, and also Justice for Liz McGriff Facebook page.
Okay. And Theo Finn.
GRHP.org and HomeRochester.org.
That's the Greater Rochester Housing Partnership. Thanks to all of you for being here. Once again, we invited City Hall and the mayor's office. We're not available today, but this is a conversation that will certainly continue. Our thanks to Rob, to Megan, to Audrey, and thanks for listening. Talk to you tomorrow.